Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight is an author whom I have been chomping at the bit to speak to. It's another bucket list moment for me. My guest tonight is Jeff Abbott, whose new book, Blame, sits squarely at the top of my best of books for this year. It is absolutely amazing. I was talking in the green room to Jeff before we started. I said, this is a thriller on speed. It is an incredible book. So Jeff has all kinds of really fun things to talk about tonight. It's my pleasure to welcome Jeff Abbott to the show. Jeff, welcome to Authors on the Air, and thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Pam, and thanks for all your nice words about the book.
It's incredible. You know, I love thrillers and mysteries and suspense and everything, but this is ratcheted up like, I don't know. It's so fast-paced, and there are so many little pieces to the puzzle that it isn't even until you put the last piece in place that you sit back and go, oh, my God, really? Really? The surprises just don't stop at the end of this book. It's like one reveal after the other, after the other, after the other. Congratulations on a spectacular piece of writing. It truly magnificent.
Oh, thank you. That's just really kind and generous of you. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Well, thank you for writing such a great book. I have to say I'm not the only one who says this. The Associated Press says you know how to ratchet up tension better while maintaining great characters and terrific plots. No kidding. PW loves everything you write. It's an adrenaline rush that won't stop, that's for sure. Twisty, turny, terrific, yes. Edge of your pants, spy caper, not a spy caper, but it's great. Lots of actions and plot twists make this a literary roller coaster. Just spectacular reviews and well-deserved. You know, it occurs to me that when I started reading about you a little bit more in depth, and, you know, I've got probably half your books sitting on my shelves, I did not realize that you have so many books and you've won so many awards. You've won the Edgar, you've won the Anthony, you've won a thriller award, you've won you've been a nominee for the Edgar, you've gotten the Agatha, the McCavity for a bunch of your books. You are just so prolific. Tell me how you decided to start writing, Jeff.
Well, the very first time I was encouraged to write, I was in second grade. And if you recall show and tell, where you bring something. And I never had anything to bring in because I was boring. So I would get up and I would start to tell a story to the kids in the class. And I think very early I knew about the power of the cliffhanger, because my story would end something like, okay, well, I spent the weekend with cowboys fighting dragons in Montana, and then I would find some point in the story where everyone gasped, and then I'd stop and I'd say, I'll tell you more tomorrow. And this was disruptive to the class. So the teacher had to call my parents in because the kids wouldn't settle down after show and tell. And she said, I think we need to channel this in a positive way. So she told them to get me a Big Chief tablet and a Husky pencil and for me to write these stories down. And so that was sort of when I was, you know, first encouraged to write. I had always been a big, big reader. My mother taught second grade in a little small East Texas town for about 40 years. And so she taught me to read at a young age and was always giving me books. So I always enjoyed reading a lot and then, you know, just telling stories, and tried writing my first novel in high school. And it was just awful, really terrible. And I would write it in these spiral notebooks, and my math and my science teachers would collect them from me at the beginning of class so I would pay attention. Then went to college and I was an English major and thought, I ought to try to write literary stuff. and I just could not get into it. But I loved reading mysteries and had always loved reading mysteries and suspense. And I was very lucky. I went to college in Houston at Rice University, and just a few blocks away from Rice is Murder by the Book, which is one of the great independent mystery bookstores in the country, in the world. And so,
well, you just did a signing there, didn't you? You just did
a
signing last week there? Yeah.
I just did it on Saturday there. So that was the first store where they had a book signing that I attended, and it was Sue Grafton, C is for Corpse. And I didn't have enough money to buy hardcover. I had to buy the paperback, and I had to apologize to her that I was buying the paperback instead of a new hardcover. And she told me that was fine. You know, she reassured me that she was just glad to get me started reading her series. So kind of at some point after that, I thought, well, maybe I should try writing a crime novel, you know. Although it was like, where do you put the clues in? How do you resolve it? All that seemed a total mystery to me. But I wrote a book, and I finished it. It was terrible, but I finished it. And that showed me I could finish. I could reach the end, which I think a lot of writers who aspire to write struggle with. And then the second book I wrote actually sold. So, and I've been published ever since.
Wow. So you didn't work a day job, or did you?
I did. No. I worked a day job. My first book sold when I was 29 and came out when I was 30. And I didn't leave my day job until Panic sold overseas and sold the film. And I think that was book number 8. So I worked a day job quite a while. I would get up at 4 a.m. and write for three hours before I went to the day job.
Wow. You said something to me that kind of, you know, was on my list of things to talk to you about, and you said that Panic sold for film. You've had quite a bit of luck in getting option for film for a lot of your books, particularly Adrenaline, not only Panic, but Collision also. And you have maybe a little something you can share?
Yeah.
About television?
Yes, I can. Thank you for asking. Well, Panic sold to Harvey Weinstein, who's famous for being one of the founders of Miramax and producing films like Chicago and Lord of the Rings and Pulp Fiction. He got the film option on it right before it came out in 2005, and he has renewed that option every time it's come up for renewal. So he's had it for 11 years. And he'd had two screenplays written for feature film, not by me, by well-known screenwriters, but he wasn't quite happy with them. And he called me last year and said he had started expanding into scripted television. And so, like, on TV, he's done, with the BBC, he did a 10-part adaptation of War and Peace. On Netflix, he does Peaky Blinders and Marco Polo. On MTV, he does Scream. The TV series, on History Channel, he does Steel Team 6. So he's doing a lot of TV. And I agreed to work with him on this, which is why he was at the Edgars last year when I was president of MWA and I was the host for the Edgars. People were like, why is Harvey Weinstein here? I was like, well, he's here for me, but I wasn't going to say much about that. But here he is. He's kind of hard to miss him. He's well known. And So I finished writing the pilot episode for the TV series to be based on Panic, and I've just gotten notes back from them, so I'll be doing some rewriting on that. And he's been really great to work with. He has a wonderful team there, a wonderful producer named Kat Hobbs, who works on a lot of his book-to-film or book-to-TV adaptations. And so this has been an interesting experience for me. I've never written for television before. And, you know, it's kind of like writing a novel in one way in that you don't know what you're doing, but you just sit down and do it, which is the approach that I took.
Well, you know, There are a couple questions I have, so if you excuse me for just a second.
Of course.
You said he bought the rights to the book before it was even out, before it was released. How did he find out about this? Did your agent pitch this as a film?
My film agent sends out the book sometimes when they're in ARC form or manuscript form.
Right.
And he,
sure.
One of his producers had gotten it, and they bought it. He read it over a weekend, and they bought it on Monday. So, but one of his assistants had read it and then pitched it to him, and then he read it and bought it and has hung on to it. So it's a book he really liked.
Now, the other thing that's interesting to me is that generally once the book is – the rights are sold for either film or television, the author really doesn't have a lot of say in what's going on. So, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who you know, like Craig Johnson and Longmire and, Jeff Deaver, you know all these people and David Morrell and everybody else who've written and had their work turned into film or television. And they usually are not – involved in the writing of anything on film that belongs to them. Now, there are plenty of people, as you know, like Lee Goldberg and Paula Vine, who write television, and just recently on one of our other shows, Jordan Harper writes for Gotham. So how did it feel to have to pick apart that book for episodic television? Was it difficult?
No, it was an interesting challenge. I mean, it's a book I'd written 12 years earlier, and I've learned a lot since then. And television has changed a lot since then in terms of what we look for in protagonists. We're much more comfortable with damaged or of gray protagonists than what we have been used to in the past. It was like a dissection. I had to go back through the book and really think about, okay, would this character work in television? Could I merge two characters? Does this subplot work? Do we need a stronger subplot, than what I have here? You have to look really at the book's strengths and the book's faults. With a
sure.
very careful eye, because television is very unforgiving. But, it's sort of interesting. Harlan Coben is a friend of mine, and he has been deeply involved with four television series based either on books of his or ideas of his in France and Britain, which isn't quite so Hollywood in terms of what he can do. He's much more involved as a direct force in the shaping of those shows. So when Harvey came to me and said, would you work on this with me? I said, yeah, but if I really just get to work on it. I mean, I have another television project based on something that based on one of my works, I'm not involved with at all. And it's making pretty good progress. That one I can't say much about because I'm not involved with it. And
sure.
It's not as far along as Panic. But it is, I'm glad of the opportunity, and I think Harvey is happy to be working with me on this, that he loves, and that I have been willing to adapt it, not just, rip what's on the book page and stick it on the
right.
screen. That doesn't work. You have to write it for television, for the medium, and you have to be willing to change.
Well, so that's my question. Yeah, so that's my question to you. Excuse me for interrupting you, but – it's a lot different when you're writing episodic television, which is done in 12 minute pieces or something, or 10 minute pieces. So a lot of the narrative kind of gets lost. That is left to somebody else to do. When you're really dialogue is what you're doing and action pretty much, correct, to make the story work. So you've got to kind of, I don't know, it's kind of like deboning the chicken. You got to pull out all off the skin and the bone, and then you've got to get right to the meat of it, and somebody else will work on whatever the set looks like or the backgrounds or everything, correct?
That's true. I certainly do in the script describe what the settings look like, probably in too much detail. That'll probably get scaled down as I rewrite. But, you know, I also want Harvey or one of the producers or any actor that he is sharing this with to be able to envision the world of this story based on what I've put in the script. So, you know, I think it's, and in that case, I think it was probably fine to probably put too much in, at least in the first draft, and we can scale it back
sure.
as we need it.
So there are two things. Would you do this? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Say it again.
I was just going to say it's the same story, just told in a different way.
So tell listeners about Panic, because, and then I want to go back to Blame, because it's one. Well, there are a couple that are really my favorites of yours, but let's talk about Panic and the. That book particularly, so that
sure.
listeners will understand what we're talking about. Go right ahead and explain
sure.
the premise.
Panic's premise is, what if everything in your life was a lie? And it's about a young documentary filmmaker who gets a frantic call from his mom to come home immediately, and he does, and he finds her murdered on the kitchen floor, and someone tries to kill him, string him up in a noose in the kitchen, and as he's dying, or, you know, choking to death, someone else shoots through the rope, chases off the killer, and says, "You have to come with me." And everything this young man, his name is Evan Casher, thought about his life, his past, his parents, his future, his friends, is all a lie. None of it is what he thinks it is. So he has to go on the run to try to find who has killed his mother and who is trying to kill him, try to find his father, and try to find out the truth about his family. So
this it sounds like the Truman Show, but in thriller form. You know, what you think is true isn't. It's an illusion. I love the premise of this, and I love this book, by the way. I do have this book on my shelf, so I will admit to that. This this book was nominated for a Thriller Award also. You also have two other novels that have been optioned. Let's just briefly touch on those, Adrenaline and Collision. We don't know the status of those right now because you're not actively working on those. Let's talk about Adrenaline for a moment, please.
Yeah, Adrenaline is the first in the Sam Capra series, which is about a former CIA agent who ends up owning bars all around the world. And in the first one, Sam is still a CIA agent. His pregnant wife is kidnapped in front of him in London, and then his CIA office is bombed, and he is the sole survivor. And then he has to escape from CIA custody to try to locate his wife and his newborn child. And that was the first in that series. It's not presently under option. The option on it, I didn't renew it with the producers that had it. Collision, the other book that I have under option, is a standalone thriller about an ordinary business executive who gets teamed up with a former CIA assassin. It's sort of like The Odd Couple in thrillers. And there is a script for that, and that's still under option with its production company, and the screenwriter's done a very good job on the script. So that's kind of in their court to see what they do with that now.
How exciting. How exciting. Are you shopping your other books too? Or is your agent shopping your other books? Would you like to have more out there?
They're always being shopped, and in fact, we've gotten a couple of inquiries for Film Rights to Blame, just based on the reviews that it's getting. You know, just asking.
Oh my God!
People send us the book. So.
Okay, so I want to talk about blame specifically, but first I want to let everyone know that Jeff Abbott is with me. I'd love for you to call in and say hello. I actually have an extra copy of his book that I'm willing to send you if you want to call in. You know, first come, first serve. The number is 347-633-9609. I have to tell you that I was so unprepared for this book. Let's tell listeners the basic story because it's magnificent.
Oh, well, thank you. You're just so kind, Pam. Blame.
I love the book. I can't help it. I know I'm gushing. But, you know.
I know. That's when I love a book, too. I do the same thing.
Yeah, you know, when I can't get a book out of my mind, there's something there. And, you know, Jeff, we talked before the show. I told you I'm a voracious reader. I actually read across genre. I read just about everything except for horror because it scares me too bad. I mean, I even got scared by Vincent Price movies. And you know, you were talking about literary fiction. I chuckled because I was thinking, yeah, I'm not smart enough to understand literary fiction, the angst of it all. And, you know, I just don't get it. So I'm ashamed to say I don't read literary fiction. I do read genre. I'm a genre fiction girl. But there are just those few books that come along and make such an impression on me. So at the end of every year, the network does a book of the year. They do an awards. We've been doing it for years and years and years. And we have a group of readers. And as the one of the show hosts, I get to submit a book for them to read. And I've already submitted your book for them to read for book of the year. Yeah.
Oh,
so,
thank you.
I'll let you know what happens. You're welcome. But
okay.
Let's talk about this book. You give the synopsis, please.
Okay. Blame is about a young woman named Jane Norton living in an affluent suburb of Austin, Texas. And when she's a senior in high school, she's the driver in a terrible one-car crash that she survives. But her neighbor, the boy next door, David Hall, is killed in the crash. And David loses his life, but Jane loses her memory. She loses the previous 3 years of her life. So basically she doesn't remember high school. And when the book opens, it's 2 years later, this accident has destroyed her life. She doesn't have the mental capacity to stay in college. So she's dropped out. She's homeless. She's eating off her friend's meal plan at his dorm at a local college in Austin. Her next-door neighbors hate her because they blame her for the accident. And her life has just been tatters. And someone starts posting on her abandoned Facebook page on the second anniversary of the crash, "I know what you claim you don't remember. All will pay." And later that same day, "All Will Pay" is written in chalk on David Hall's tombstone. And then things start happening to people who are connected to the crash. And Jane, who still has amnesia, decides that she is going to investigate not only the crash, but who she was 2 years ago. What kind of person was she? Why were she and David in that car? Why were they out late at night when they shouldn't have been, and what really happened that night? So it's a mystery, but there's a lot of mysteries that Jane has to solve that are all interconnected.
Oh, my goodness. It was like peeling the onion. You peel off the skin and there's the story right there in front of you. I mean, you lay it all out in the first chapter. It's no surprise what's happening, but what happens after that and her determination eventually to figure it all out and all the obstacles that are thrown in her way, the false starts, the dead ends, the red herrings, it was mind numbing trying to figure it out. You almost needed a scorecard, except that your story weaving was so good that just when I thought I knew what was going on, I didn't know what was going on. And I'm pretty good at figuring out mysteries and things like that. You just don't give an inch away, not an inch. You made me very suspicious, but you don't give an inch away. And to me, when I keep, as I said, when I keep thinking about that story over and over and over again, and I have, and it continues to, I mean, I'm so stunned by the book. It continues to stay in my mind. It, to me, is a sign of a really great book. Laura Lippman, who's a doll, you know, I've met her in the past. She said, you are one of her favorite writers. I can understand that. I've been reading your books for a while now. And so congratulations on it. Tell me what people are saying to you when you go to book signings. I'm really curious.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there were some, I mean, I think people are a little surprised by the book. You know, a lot of people at book signings haven't read it yet. They're just buying it then.
Right.
But there, we've people who came who might have bought it in ebook form the day it came out, and they ended up, they told me they read it in, you know, one sitting. They read it in one day. My favorite is a friend of mine's wife, who only does audiobooks, and this is my first multi-reader audiobook. You know, I've got, I think it's got four different readers in the audiobook, and it's a 12-hour, you know, journey, and she did it in less than a day, which is pretty fast for an audiobook. So I think people are, I think they're curious about why I decided to write about an amnesiac. That question has come up a lot. And
but a high school, a kid, you know, the generation that you're writing about too. It's so spot on. Now, I know you have children yourself. Are your kids about the same age as the kids in this book?
Yeah,
they are.
I have a 18-year-old and a 16-year-old. And you know, that is, you mentioned Laura Lippman. She was one of the people who encouraged me to write this book. I was scared to write it because I said I'm an older guy, and here I'm going to have a protagonist who's a 19-year-old, you know, female. Could I do this? Could I do it honestly and responsibly, and could I do the character justice? And she and Megan Abbott and Allison Galen all are friends of mine. And they all encouraged me. They
said,
you've been writing really great female characters for years. I think you can do this. And so I said, okay, I'll try. And it'll either work or it will fail spectacularly. And, you know, the reviews have been really kind. And a number of the reviews have pointed out that that I'm not a teenage young woman, but I'm good at representing how her mind works. And I just tried to think about, you know, no, I haven't been exactly in her shoes, but we all know what it is to feel alone, to feel like a failure, to feel like nothing you can do is right, like you're in a situation you can't fix. And so I tried to tap into the commonality of emotions that we feel, our common, you know, humanity. And then I had to say, put it, okay, but it's all in her perspective. And she's 19 years old. She doesn't remember high school. People have joked with me. They wish, how do you forget high school? Is that a trick? I'd like to know how to do that. But, you know,
I never want to forget high school. It was great for me. But you know what stood out for me, though? Well, the thing that stood out for me is the manipulation that to me was very obvious, but I couldn't figure out why. That was the conundrum for me, because I recognize that this is probably a very, very intelligent young woman who was so consumed with grief and with guilt and with everything, you know, with all the names that people were calling her and how she was ostracized and she was suspicious and everything. And it made me suspicious of everyone, too. It made me completely suspicious of everyone. And I really kind of jumped right into that character and so latched on to her. And but I, you know who I didn't latch on to is her mother. I hated her mother from jump. Isn't that terrible? I didn't even give her a chance.
Well, you know, it's interesting to talk about the cast of characters. We've had lots of big thrillers like Gone Girl, The Girl on the Train,
right,
The One with Cabin 10, all excellent, that center on the unreliable narrator, the person who's sharing the story but not be telling you the whole truth. I wanted to invert that situation. I wanted to do something different with it. So I have a character who is a blank slate and is dependent on the people around her to tell her who she was, what kind of person she was, what kind of life she led. And so she is surrounded by unreliable narrators who may be lying to her to try to protect her, or may be lying to her to keep a dark secret or to hurt her. And that was something, when I was reading Amnesia Memoirs, that really jumped out at me, because, you know, you get amnesia from a physical injury. You recover from the physical injury, they just send you home. You may not remember home. You may not remember your family.
Right.
There is no Jason Bourne outpatient center for amnesia for them to go sit around and hope the memories come back. So again and again, you would see in these accounts of where people, their loved ones would try to shape them into being the person they wanted to be, despite if it wasn't the person they had been before. I thought this is a way to play with the idea of the unreliable narrator. I just have the heroine surrounded by them. And a big part of the book is...
What an interesting concept, though, Jeff. Yeah. Excuse me for interrupting. The concept to me of she doesn't remember, and so this is a do-over for someone else to try to remake her. It's a concept to me that is fascinating, even though it necessarily wasn't the whole point, but in a lot of ways it was. So with the unreliable narrator, it's interesting to me. I have had concussions, and I don't remember the exact moment of it, maybe, you know, within 30 minutes or something. I can't tell you exactly what happened, but I just can't imagine having to rebuild my missing period of time, even if it was a week. I mean, it sends me off the deep end when I can't remember where I put my keys, you know. Is it, memory is so fragile, and it's so personal, and it's so intricate to whom we are. It's an indelible part of who we are as an individual.
Right.
So I love the way that you played memory in this. You used her lack of memory, or her question, am I really remembering, or am I imagining this, or am I taking this from what somebody's telling me? I mean, what?
Right.
You know, it's like a triptych. You're looking at all three different pictures, and you're thinking, okay, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, which one is it, you know? So kudos to you for doing a brilliant book. It was fantastic. I want
to
ask you, I bet it was. Are you writing another book right now? I want to just say to all those of you who are listening, Jeff and his family just were very blessed to escape a very horrible event. Their house was destroyed by lightning. And so I don't know, Jeff, if you were actually in the process of writing, or if you're in the middle, I know you're touring right now for the book. Had you begun to write prior to the release of Blame?
Oh, yeah. I have a book due July. I have a book due in a week from today.
Oh, Jesus, God.
When right before the lightning strike hit, I had written about 3,000 words that day. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to be finished with the book in about 4 or 5 days. And then we had the lightning strike and the house burned. And that was obviously, you know, we all got out, our pets got out, but the house was a loss. So it kind of derailed me. That was a little over 2 weeks ago. I think I'm going to finish the next book either later tonight or tomorrow.
You put your stuff in the cloud so you don't lose it, right?
I didn't lose any of the manuscripts. We've moved twice in the past 2 weeks. We've been staying at friends' houses who are on vacation. Our neighborhood has been a huge help to us. We're trying to get into a more permanent place because we face eight to 12 months of rebuilding the house. And I am supposed to be working on this television pilot, and I have a book due, which I am trying to get finished and get sent to my editor before she so she can take it on a long flight when she goes on vacation.
No pressure there at all, right? No pressure at all for you. Jeez.
No, it's been hard, but it's also been good for me to focus on that. But you know, I've been in this business a long time, and I try to meet my deadlines. Hell or high water or lightning strike.
You know, isn't that a hell of a thing to have to add to the lexicon there and to the narrative? You know, I survived the lightning strike to burn down my home, but I'm still going. I mean, these are things that you're not supposed to have to say. Before we get to the end of the show, will you please tell everyone where they can find you on the web?
Where they can find me on the web is jeffabbott.com.
Okay.
I have a whole list of all my books and all the foreign editions of my books as well there.
Good.
And there's also a way to contact me or to contact my publicist. And there are descriptions and excerpts of all the books. So if people haven't read me before or they want to read an excerpt from Blaine, there's all of that is available.
Don't even read the excerpt. Just buy the damn book, please. You just do yourself a favor and buy the damn book. It's just so good. You know, if you don't believe me, you can call me right now and I'll give you one. 347-633-9609. Jeff's also on the web, on Facebook. He is really good about responding to stuff. You know, it stunned me. I went to your pages to look at you and there you were posting away. So, you know, that's shouldering on for really, really great, and congratulations on that. Normally, at the end of this show, I try to do final five with my guests. It's five quick questions and five quick answers. Are you game to play?
Sure.
Okay, so are you going to go outside with an umbrella anymore? Lightning outside? No, I'm just teasing. My bad.
It stormed here today. Yes, I went outside. So.
God. You know, I told you I'm in lightning strike capital of the world. I live in Southwest Florida, and, you know, it is the storm season for those of us in the South. So, you know, we're kind of used to it. I do not live on lakefront property except during the summer, and then I live on lakefront property. Whose book are you reading right now, Jeff?
I'm reading In a Dark, Dark Wood by Ruth Ware. It was her book she wrote before The Woman in Cabin 10.
Wow. When you first started writing, I don't mean in second grade, but when you first tried that novel the first time around again, you thought you wanted to write mystery. Who were you reading then? Do you recall?
I was reading a lot of Agatha Christie. Reading a lot of John D. McDonald.
Yep.
And probably reading back then, I think, a lot of Josephine Tay, who I think is underrated and should be read more.
Yeah.
So.
Fabulous. That's how got me hooked on mystery. I read Agatha Christie and I thought it was so good that I went to the bookstore, a little indie bookstore down the street from where I worked, and I got every single book in order of publication, even though it wasn't necessary. And I think she read 110 books. They were little skinny ones. Remember, they used to be on the rack.
Yeah.
And so I read all of them. I read one a day, and the bookstore owner said, "I'm not going to charge you anymore. Just bring it back the next day, put it on the rack. I'll give you the next one." And that's what happened. And that started my love affair with mysteries. Isn't that funny?
That is very.
But I read John D. McDonald and Parker and Leonard all of those. I mean, you had to. John D. McDonald. I mean, listen, I lived in Florida. I had to read The Busted Flush and Travis McGee. Mm-hmm. I used to go up to the marina there to look for it. It was just so fascinating to me. What would we be surprised to learn about you?
I don't know. I'm actually pretty much an introvert. I think people, because when they meet me at conferences, I kind of have my conference face on and I'm outgoing. But I'm generally an introvert. My wife is the extrovert. I'm happy sort of in normal life to kind of hang back a little bit. But when you're at conferences, you kind of have to have your dang face on. And, you know, you're also around a lot of your friends that you don't get to see very often. So,
right.
But in regular life, I'm quieter than people think that I am.
Would you believe that if I said the same thing about me? No, you wouldn't, because it's not true. I'm the one with the big personality. But you were the president of Mystery Writers of America. Didn't you just turn that over to Jeff? I mean, how
yeah.
could you be an introvert? That's so funny.
Just a figurehead. when you're president, the president only has to host the Edgars. All the heavy lifting is done by the national board, and they do a fantastic job.
Can you imagine? But Jeff is great, and he's on a couple times a year. I love that man. He's fabulous, and I hope he'll come back too. Tell me something on your bucket list.
I would like to. Well, I've already done a fair amount of that. Something on my bucket list. I would like to go to Montreal. That's the city I've always wanted to visit.
Beautiful.
It seems like a small, easily done thing, but I've never done it, and I'd really like to go visit. I need to improve my French a little
bit. Don't go in the winter. I will tell you,
winter.
No,
I think I'll go in the summer.
It's butt freezing cold. But the underground city is magnificent. It's a beautiful place. It is just too cold for words. There should not be winter that cold. It's so cold. Well, I was a lot younger too, and I could probably tolerate it better. But and there's a great writing community there, so that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Everybody that I speak to, all the authors I speak to, tell me that they have kind of their writer's toolbox. You know, that they're whether it's a place they have to sit or a candle they have to burn or they have to face to the window or only, whatever it happens to be, do you have anything in your writer's toolbox that you want to tell me about?
I don't have a lot of rituals, that I have to be at a certain place or what have you.
Right.
I like to listen to movie soundtracks while I'm writing, like Inception or The Hours. Those are two really good ones. And I keep a paper notebook with all my notes in it. I don't really like electronic notes. So I tend to use these, they're called Clairefontaine notebooks. They're from France, and I really like the paper in them. And that is what I keep all my notes in, and every book I start gets a new Clairefontaine notebook.
I
have a label maker, and I put the title of the book on the notebook. So I can always, look at the front and see which book it is. But it's good quality
pen and paper underrated, aren't they, Jeff?
Yes, they are. They are.
They're underrated. I love pen and paper. I love writing thank you notes on paper. I love handwriting them. I like stamps. My post office thinks I'm the best thing since sliced bread because I get every stamp known to man. And I try to match my stamps to the person that I'm sending the note to. It's crazy. I'm a little odd. So, my final question to you is, when people ask you what you do for a living, do you tell them you're an author or a writer?
I say I'm a writer.
Why don't you say you're an author?
I don't know. I don't know. It's easier to say that I'm a writer.
It's more passive form of what you do, isn't it? It says you're in the process of doing things.
Yeah. I've just always found it easier to say that. Author sometimes can sound a little pretentious, although it's not.
It isn't.
It's not. I'm proud to be an author.
It is not.
And I think I may have said that once, and someone didn't hear or understand what I said. Everyone understands when you say you're a writer. So, and then they always ask, what do I write? And, so then I have to answer that. But or they've heard of me.
All right. Well, let me ask you this. Do they ever say to you, do I know anything that you've written?
Yes.
Which
yeah.
is my favorite question people ask authors. I don't know. Do you?
I don't know. Yeah. What have you read lately? They're always trying to be nice when they say that, you know.
Right.
I feel it's always coming from a place of goodness, but it's so funny just when they ask that. So I just always say, well, I write suspense novels. If you've bought a book in an airport, you may have bought one of mine. And, often will ask them who they like to read, you know, and then I can sort of put my work into conjunction with who they like to read, you know, and place it accordingly. So anyway.
Well, I have to tell you that authors are my celebrities. You were talking about movies and TVs. I don't own a television. I haven't for a long time. I'd rather read, but I'm probably the biggest fangirl. And when people say, what do you do? And I tell them I'm a talk show host, they say, well, who do you speak to? And I said, I speak to the world's most famous authors. And they say, really, who? And how do you run down, how do you say that? I just tell them, well, do you like to read? Well, yes, who do you like to read? And, you know, there's the few that you see on the grocery store shelf every single time. And I say, well, them and more. You know?
Right.
So,
right.
But I say author because, to me, that has meat on the bones. That's weighty. It's important. And you guys are my celebrities.
Well,
I want to thank you so much for being with me, Jeff. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I'd love for you to come back and sit behind the microphone and interview your friend Harlan Coben one day. It's an easy arrange. I'd love to do it. Will you think about it?
I will think about that.
You know, or you could just have a conversation together. We do a series called In Conversation, where it's just two authors talking about books and writing and, you know, process or whatever they want to talk about. You are an absolute joy and a delight. I thank you so much for being with me. Congratulations on the success of Blame and all of your other stuff. I'm going to call you one day and I'm going to ask you about Panic and where it is. And I want you to come back and tell me if it's on television. Will you do that?
Sure, of course. Thank you so much for having me on, Pam. You're a delight. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank Down and Out Books for providing sponsorship for this program. They are celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction. You can find out more at www.downandoutbooks.com. Thank you, Jeff Abbott. Thank you, listeners. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Have a great night, everybody. Night.
Good night.